Well, welcome everyone. We seem to have a fairly select group here for the Insurance Regulation Reimagined session. So I'm looking forward to lots of quality input from you all after our presenters have had a chance to bring us up to speed with the subject. Essentially today we have Rob Curtis leading the presentation. For some of you, Rob may not need much of an introduction, but he's been employed now with KPMG internationally for many years, and prior to that with the former FSA in the UK. I think some of us in the room certainly remember Rob's role quite vividly in one of the architects, I think it'd be fair to say, of the ComFrame project, which is essentially the process by which the IAIS determined the approach it would try to take to the common regulation of globally active insurance groups, which was quite a long and drawn-out process, and has obviously now helped the IAIS respond to the FSB's demands about creating a global capital standard for insurers. So obviously he brings a vast amount of experience at an international level to this, even though he's now returned to practice in Australia and the Asian area based in Melbourne. His colleague, Julian Braganza, also works in this space, having worked previously at Zurich, Australia, and is focusing very much on looking at, I think, industry responses to the ongoing regulatory change. I expect that they will speak for somewhere in the vicinity of about 30 minutes, and then hopefully we should have about 15 minutes of questions. So without any further ado, I invite Rob to kick us off.
Thanks, Tony, and afternoon, everyone. It's always good to have a select group to the presentations. The subject matter today, what we'll do is we'll go through basically provide you with an overview of just what some of the changing regulatory landscape is globally. A lot of people, I think, in Australia sometimes think, well, it's all well and good, but actually how does it really affect me here domestically? And some of the things we'll take you through today, I think there's quite a significant set of actions which are going to come out from the global supervisors. And APRA, of course, wanting to be a good, you know, corporate citizen of the regulatory community, will clearly be under some pressure to download, if you like, those global sets of expectations into local requirements. So we'll go through a little bit of that. Julian will take you through the ICS, that's the new internal insurance capital standard that they're looking to build, and the GCs and the DCs. Lots of acronyms, of course, in insurance, but the Global Systemically Important Insurer, and next month the IAIS. And this is why it does matter what's happening at the global level, because next month the IAIS will come out with a DC paper for domestic systemically important insurers. And like it or not, HIH is always held up within the IAIS regulatory community as the poster child for a DC. So APRA will be under some pressure to say, okay, well, we probably have some systemically important insurers here in Australia. Therefore, we'll have to look at rolling out that sort of program. But, of course, with all of these global programs, usually, and Basel's a classic case of what happened on the banking side, effectively it starts for the very few, the very largest at the top, and bit by bit it actually goes all the way down, and everyone actually starts to then have to do these new requirements. So what is happening there is will be of interest, I think, to local insurers. Then what I want to do is change the focus. I'll come back and talk about risk culture. I know it's probably, you've heard it a million times over now, risk culture. It seems to be the sort of flavour of the month, or has been for a while. But really sort of tie that into conduct risk, because I think this is probably the next biggest regulatory issue that will hit the Oz market. So without further ado, what is the changing landscape looking like? Some key themes. For most presentations, you only remember 30%. So here's the first, key takeaways, and then you can, have a view after that. But effectively, group-wide supervision is where they're all going. So this is going to be very important in the context of particularly those Australian groups who are looking to either go abroad or even internally here, look at managing themselves better. And of course, one of those aspects that they're looking at is recovery and resolution plans, RRPs, and this will become quite closely linked to all of the DC work, because that will be a key component of how you're, managing your risk management overview and oversight internally through these, basically living will type concepts. So that's what the recovery resolution plan is. APRA's been quite honest, I think, and said, well, they probably don't really see the need for the resolution component of an RRP, but the recovery aspect is probably something they're quite interested in. And effectively, there is already a large degree of that happening through the reverse stress testing requirement in the ICAP anyway. So you're starting to get some of those concepts through. And all of that means, though, is just what is the sort of capital and financial position of the group. But it sort of then goes wider and says, well, actually, what's the impact potentially on the group as a whole with things like third-party providers, flows of capital between what are the dependencies, even who's actually paying salaries if there is a crisis and one of these entities gets shut down, what do you do? So those sorts of concepts will flow through, I think, more and more. APRA is probably a little bit still undecided as to how much they want to go forward in terms of new requirements. I think they're looking for a period of somewhat stability, which is to be thankful for. But I think actually what they'll do is what they've already got, they'll just start beefing up a little bit. Globally, risk-based capital frameworks, not new here in Australia, but clearly in Asia, for example, this is a really big changing dynamic for most jurisdictions. So you've seen China have recently come out with their CROSS. That's their basic RBC equivalent. It's modelled off something like Solvency II, where KPMG are actually helping the Hong Kong regulator now, the OCI, the Office of Commissioner of Insurance, basically develop their new RBC framework. They've outsourced it effectively because they just don't have the resources or the capabilities internally to do it. So I'm up there a lot in Hong Kong leading that work. But you're starting to see all sorts of others. I was just in India last week with the IRDA there needing to move to an RBC framework. Thailand's doing theirs. And you're starting to see lots of other jurisdictions, not just in Asia Pacific, but also globally, now moving to this RBC type concept. So the DCs, GCs we've talked about and what that looks like. This whole focus on non-traditional non-insurance activities, NTNI, so it's another acronym that's been out there for a while, but particularly, the focus there is looking at, your sort of market risk-related elements and instruments, particularly those sorts of derivatives and other sort of instruments which actually might give rise to some greater risk in the system. That's something that they're looking at, and of course, the other thing to remember with all of this is, the sector itself, the insurance sector, is a large investor in government bonds and gilts, not just in Australia but globally. So it becomes quite a political issue for a lot of the governments that, you don't want major investors in those gilts experiencing issues around solvency. So this is why, these sorts of concepts matter at the regulatory level. Rising importance of risk culture, that's not just an Australian phenomenon, although Ian Lachlan, when he was there as the member, picked that up and ran with it, if you like, here in Australia. But basically, a lot of this was emanating from the UK, particularly on the banking side, where, the latest estimate, they're at about £32 billion for remediation costs for mis-selling in the banking sector over there. So that is enormous. For every £1 coming in, 16 was being spent on remediation. So just a colossal issue over there. And that was really coming back down to, from the FSA's perspective and the PRA now, what the prevailing culture was within those banks at the time. And, of course, like it or not, the insurance sector always, has a bit of a cascading effect from banking across to it. And so some of those themes, if you like, have certainly come across. And last but not least on this, in terms of what's happening globally, on the conduct side, there is going to be, now that EIOPA, which is effectively the European regulator, has basically, or supervisory body, has basically now finished Solvency II on the prudential side. They're on record for saying that, you know, their next focus is going to be on conduct, and that is where they'll now look to have Europe come under one conduct regime, effectively. So if you look at conduct now in Europe, you have, you know, 28 different member states all having a different set of requirements on the conduct side. So Solvency II, prudentially, everyone comes under the one basket. Conduct, everyone's still doing their own thing. And in some countries, like Ireland, for example, there is no real conduct set of requirements at all, certainly in terms of customer protection. So that is going to be an area, and the reason why that really matters globally is because once EIOPA and those supervisors start getting their act together properly on conduct, and that's going to be happening, has started, but you'll start to see that happen this year and then into next, that actually will go through the IIS. And the IIS will then actually, all its work so far on the ICPs, the Insurance Core Principles, have effectively been around prudential supervision. And moving to conduct will now actually mean that you'll start to see a lot more effectively high-level requirements coming through from the IIS level. And that in turn means countries like Australia and APRA have to then toe the line and start doing something. So it'll either be APRA or ASIC. Where, what bucket that falls into is always an open, interesting question, particularly with what's going on now. But I think you'll find also that there'll be enough pressure on APRA to start looking at some of the conduct issues. And they can't just sort of say, well, this is an ASIC issue. We don't have anything to look at it, because there is a what is the impact on solvency coming back. So that's sort of just to give you a broad overview of what is just happening at that level. The global framework itself, the more you become a larger entity, the more you actually start to have different requirements applying. And so if I can just use this, you know, you at this level down here, you've got your solo entities, for example, and as you get larger, you start to see the bigger requirements coming into play. So the internationally active insurance groups, the IAIGs, the global systemically important insurer stuff. What it means is you get more and more requirements applying, particularly around these systemic risk management plans that you have to submit, you know, enhanced liquidity issues that they're looking at, you know, how are you actually really managing that. These RRPs I mentioned, crisis management groups, all of this sort of then starts coming into play. But it also means that actually the supervisors themselves are no longer, you know, trying to supervise entities alone. They're basically using the supervisory college to do this. And so if you look at the OCI in Hong Kong, they've been asked, for example, to lead the Prudential UK Regional College and ASPAC. So you'll get more and more, this is the future direction, effectively, of supervision, of how it will go. And the reason why, you know, we eventually, you know, Tony was saying at the start, you know, with ComFrame, the common framework for the supervision of these IAIGs, there's about 50 of those globally. Nine are currently what they call GCs, and Julian will speak more to all of this soon. But effectively, what they're trying to do there is saying, well, actually, we've got to have a more efficient means of supervising these large groups. At the moment, our estimates are about 15 to 25 billion a year in aggregate. That it's costing the global insurance sector by having bespoke requirements in every country. And it's an absolute nonsense. You know, credit risk, market risk, liquidity risk, operational risk, insurance risk is the same in whatever market you're in. It doesn't change simply because you've gone from Australia to the UK or the US. You know, it's fundamentally the same risk. So therefore, why is the assessment and treatment of those risks different with every country? Because at the end of the day, the supervisors all have the same common goal, which is policyholder protection. So it's sort of, you know, working back from that, you say, well, look, this is an incredibly large cost imposition on the industry at the moment by having these bespoke requirements in every country. Maybe there has to be a better way that we can get ourselves on a common platform to supervise common risks and therefore have a bit of a common language amongst us all. So that's really the sort of overarching theme of what they're trying to drive at. And, of course, I've got to say Australia is probably one of the countries which has resisted somewhat those global moves. And rightly or wrongly, APRA, I think, is quite comfortable in its own skin and happy with its own requirements. Well, that's all well and good in one sense. But then you say, well, why actually do you need to be different to what they're doing in Singapore or Hong Kong or China, for example, in the Asia-Pacific region, let alone globally? And at the end of the day, there is no real difference as to why they have to. So that's going to be an interesting one for them anyway as an organisation going forward as to how they manage that. So this all sort of links into this move towards group-wide supervision. As I say, this is effectively where the supervisors will go and how they will supervise over the next few years. It will increasingly be a college-type program. But also the real effect for a lot of groups means that actually you're no longer really just dealing with your home supervisor. You're having to have a regulatory strategy that actually can get across to all of your main, you know, constituent supervisory bodies who, you know, need to be, you know, brought along the journey, as it were, and told. Because they all sit around the table and they'll all have a view as to whether you're, how you're performing. So, you know, very important that that gets addressed properly. But effectively, you know, this whole process now about how do you actually set capital for a group, how does that actually work, at what level? You know, globally, we still don't have an internationally consistent, calibrated set for capital regulatory purposes. Why is that? Simple answer really is because the US and Europe can't agree as to what that level should be. So the US system, RBC, was done before these concepts of confidence levels and time horizons came into being effectively in the early 90s. Wasn't really there. By the sort of, you know, noughts, everyone got their act together and then said, right, well, it's got to be about 99.5, doesn't it? Because if it's not that 1 in 200 year event, you're actually below triple B. Less than that is junk bond status. Very hard for a regulator to come up with a new framework which sets capital at equivalent of a junk bond status, is it not? You know, and so that's the issue. It's one of politics more than anything else. It's not because, you know, it's technically too difficult. It's not that at all. It's just a political one of trying to actually get the US brought up in terms of its capital requirements, because best guess is we think it's around about 95% at the moment. So, you know, there's lots of issues around that, and that sort of leads us into the ICS and the capital framework, and Julian will speak more to you about where that is going, what the latest developments are and what that looks like.
All right, thanks for that, Rob. So as Rob mentioned, one of the big trends we're seeing globally is the move towards risk-based capital frameworks. And certainly this is evidenced, through example, for what we've seen in Solvency II in Europe, LAGIC in Australia, even Hong Kong is moving towards their own risk-based capital framework. And now we're seeing as well the insurance capital standards coming through with the IAIS developments. So if we look at the slide on the bottom left-hand side, so that there provides sort of a conceptual overview of the capital framework being proposed by the IAIS. So you really have a basic capital requirement, which is a baseline requirement, and what that's evolving into is the ICS, which is a risk-based capital framework, and it's viewed that this might be implemented as a sort of PCR, a prescribed capital requirement, very similar to what we have in LAGIC. What's unclear is the level of confidence that this will target. Is it going to be a 99.5% level of sufficiency? So that's one of the big contentious issues that's yet to be decided. In terms of timeframes, the ICS is likely to be implemented post 2019. So it's a bit further down the track, but the IAIS is just going through the level of thinking as the process evolves. They'll seek industry feedback and comment to ensure everyone's on the same page. Slapped on top of the ICS is the HLA, and this is the higher loss absorbency requirement, which is expected to apply to all GCs. So there's 9 of them, as Rob mentioned. And really, the reason for this is to safeguard the financial system, sort of looking back at what happened during the GFC, learning from that and saying, well, these are important insurers to the financial system. How can we support these insurers? And really, it's coming down to an excess of capital that they'll be required to hold. So that's the framework there. In terms of the ICS and what it might mean for Australia, really, I think the first step really is for us to see the methodology of what's being proposed and understanding the key capital drivers and how this might change moving on from LAGIC, per se. And in terms of the current consultation document that's been released by the IAIS, it's very similar to LAGIC. You have your risk-based charges, which is your insurance risk, operational risk, credit risk, your asset risk. So it's very similar in terms of the prescribed approach. It allows for some sort of diversification, including allowance for management actions. So we're not seeing too much of a difference with LAGIC, but I think the key thing will be where it cuts in, and if it does cut in the level below where LAGIC currently stands, then there'll be a few questions, and APRA will need to sort of reassess and see, well, do they need to come down a bit, or what is the implication of having the ICS come in at a level that's potentially below where we are at. And of course, the whole thing is centered around the ICS applying to what's called your IAIGs, which is the internationally active insurance groups, sort of the 50 insurance groups globally, the large insurance groups. So there are questions around, well, what will it mean for insurers that do not fall in this category? Are IAIGs sort of at an unfair disadvantage from a capital perspective and so forth? Obviously, it's a group-wide capital framework, so what needs to be considered is, well, the company's holding capital at a group-wide level. That assumes that then capital can be flowed, can flow between jurisdictions as and when needed. And then the question then is, well, what does it mean from the perspective of jurisdictional capital requirements? And how does that interact between the global requirement that's coming through? So there's a few questions there on how the ICS will be embedded and that will flow through in the coming years. Okay. And what we did do last year, this sort of middle of 2015, is we did, as part of our evolving insurance regulation publication that Rob leads, we conducted a CRO survey to basically get views from CROs and leads in the industry on what this might mean for them and what are their thoughts on the developments that the IAIS is putting through. And that overall, by and large, the feedback has been positive. So industry participants see that, as Rob mentioned, this allows for a common language across the globe. It enables regulators from different jurisdictions to interact and cooperate with one another and speak the same language. Because really, insurance companies are now global. They're involved in a number of jurisdictions, and being able to regulate them at a global level requires that sort of common language and common footing. So in principle, the alignment is there with the industry. And they also, I mean, the industry is seeing strong support for insurers for the regulators to collaborate with one another and come up with regulation at a sort of a group-wide level. What remains a concern amongst industry participants is how this global standard will interact with existing local requirements. And that's what I mentioned previously around whether which one would prevail if the two requirements had conflicting outcomes, and what would it mean for IAIGs that are competing in a local environment where other insurers might be subject to different regulations. So there's a couple of things there that have been pointed out, and of course it was mentioned as well that any global capital framework would need to take into account the differences and the nuances in products, features and benefits that are unique to certain jurisdictions in order to encapsulate the entirety of what insurance is globally. So if we touch in a bit more detail on GCs and DCs. So really the importance of this is, as Robert also mentioned, the sort of thinking that's happening at a global level and its application to GCs starting to sort of feedback down a level into what it might mean for domestic systemically important insurers at a local financial system. So the rationale here is, while it's happening at a global level, we're sort of seeing, well, APRA might start thinking, well, yeah, so that's good, but now what does it mean for us in Australia? Should we start thinking about our own domestic important insurers that are critical to our financial system in terms of the services that they provide? and how can we protect them if one of them was to go away? So that's the rationale for this section. Sorry. If we start briefly with just the identification process, so in terms of GCs, I know just to provide a bit of context as well as to what they are. So really, the IIS goes through an annual exercise where they look at the population of insurers and say, well, who are our largest insurers in terms of size, in terms of global activity and reach, in terms of the operation, the number of countries in which they operate in, the level of interconnectedness with other insurers, such as through the level of reinsurance transactions, the level of involvement in non-traditional insurance activities. So APRA basically does a calibration exercise, and they sample the insurers and seek out data to be able to quantify the level of systemic risk these insurers might contribute. And from that, they're able to shortlist the 9 or so GCs that are critical to the global financial system. But what we're seeing is through the various iterations of this process, the IIS is starting to open the doors and start to have a dialogue with insurers around this process. So what we're seeing is, as part of, for example, phase 3, 4, and 5, they're starting to seek information from some of these insurers to be able to justify why or why not, why they may not be classified as a GC. So really what we're seeing is it's starting to become less of a so it's becoming more transparent, this process, where insurers will have this constant dialogue with the IIS. Okay, if we now briefly touch on, so one of the key requirements for GCs is that they have in place a recovery and resolution plan. And that's what Robert also touched on previously. So really, to protect the global financial system from failure of a significant insurer, the IIS requires that all GCs should have in place a recovery and resolution plan. So this enhanced level of regulation follows the GFC in a way, and is intended to avoid a repeat of what happened, for example, by enabling GCs to recover or be wound up in a systematic manner. So really, in terms of a recovery plan, what it involves is the company basically considering a series of financial stress scenarios and sort of setting out a clear pathway of how they might be able to restore financial sustainability. And really, what they need to have in place is clear trigger points around what mitigating actions might be able to implement in order to ensure this happens. And of course, there needs to be a governance process around that, around how is this recovery and resolution plan maintained, and how is it updated to be responsive to changes in the environment. You can see there as well, there's a bit of a conversation around critical functions that an insurer provides, whether it be coverage and investments into the financial system, and if an insurer were to break down and collapse, then what might it mean for the financial economy and how can this be safeguarded? So what avenues are there for other insurers to fill the gap that another insurer might not be able to? So that's the reasoning and rationale around the recovery and resolution plan, and that's how it might sort of link in into what it means for domestically systemic important insurers. And then as Rob touched on briefly, in terms of the non-traditional non-insurance activities, this tends to be a large component in terms of the identification of GCs. It's a significant component. And really, as Rob mentioned, it's around trying to identify what products give rise to systemic risk for GCs. And what the IIS is doing is it's trying to identify from a first principles basis what are the characteristics of insurance products and features that give rise to the systemic risk. And it really, what they've narrowed it down to is substantial market risk and liquidity risk. And these two aspects through transmission channels can lead to systemic outcomes. So In terms of product features, what we're seeing is they're sort of leaning towards product guarantees and product features that allow for early withdrawal of account balances and savings. And it's this sort of mechanism that where you can have a rundown on a bank, a run out for a bank, you can have a similar outcome for insurers. So that's the sort of thinking of how it might give rise to systemic risk. And that's the sort of rationale why Australian insurers might also need to start thinking about where their involvement is in terms of how this applies to them and where it might bite. Yep. All right, if I pass on to Rob around risk culture and conduct risk.
Good. So thank you, Julian. So that's effectively, I mean, what you're starting to see at the global level there, you know, has some real meaning here in Australia, particularly for, because all of those concepts are something that, you know, every firm should know themselves equally here. So you don't have to be a GC to know what some of those exposures might be in your own entity. So around culture, I won't speak too much on this because this has probably been done to death in a way around the industry now for probably the last 12 months, 18 months. But effectively around culture, my view would be that I think there are some confused messages coming out. Obviously you've got ASIC and you're looking at it from a very much a consumer perspective, and then you've got APRA looking at it from a, you know, is the framework in place in terms of managing risks, and what does that mean? Now, our view around, you know, the APRA expectations, and I won't speak through all of these slides, they're really here for information for you to take away as well, but it's effectively what are they really driving at, you know, and clearly, you know, been talked about a lot around risk appetite, the linking back to, you know, strategy and the overall process that firms go through in terms of managing risk and the analysis and the overlay of that from the boards. And so what we find is quite helpful is when you break it down into these elements here, so you say, well, architecturally you need obviously, you know, the bare basics in play. So, you know, you've got these elements here, which you would clearly need to have. So the corporate governance risk management framework itself, strategic business planning processes, you know, the risk management strategy itself, risk appetite statement, you know, the monitoring reporting frameworks, management information systems, even remuneration policy. So all of that sort of is all good stuff. And that comes into, you know, what is the risk architecture effectively? You know, what do you have in place? And that itself should actually stand quite firm now because we've had ICAAP, we've got the 220 requirements, we've got, you know, requirement to have a CRO, you've got the FCR, you know, there's a multitude of different requirements, you know, the appointed actuary looking at risk as well. So there's a number of overlays already built into the system around the actual risk framework itself. So you say, well, if that's looking reasonable, that should actually provide a reasonable cultural sort of outcome. And then there's the other overlay, which is your behavioural competency elements itself. So strategy and direction, you know, low risk appetite, high risk appetite, what's the sort of feeling there, profit focus, customer focus. You know, and there's a number of different overlays that you can, these are just some examples, around each of these. You know, relationships, is it one of questioning or is it acceptance? You know, is it siloed working? Is it, you know, collaborative? You know, and you can overlay the behavioural elements with each of these different layers to actually get a view as to what are the sort of competencies and behavioural issues going on at particular firms. And so you need to combine the two of them effectively. You need to have a good story around what your risk architecture is and then actually look at the competencies and behaviours and say, actually, how are we measuring that? And do we actually have a system? Too many firms still, I think, in Australia are doing one or the other, you know, and they don't really have a coherent story that they can actually present, not only to their own boards, but actually to, say, to APRA. So that is a bit of a takeaway for you just to have a look at. And that sort of gets you to this place here where you can basically then start to, you know, have a bit of a diagnostic tool and say, actually, well, where are our hotspots across the different dimensions by category? And that gives you a, you know, an ability to say, well, we undertake the assessment. We have a framework, we undertake our assessment, and this is how we're scoring ourselves. And actually there is a methodology there, and there, it makes some sense. It's not just us having a feel-good factor about, you know, we manage risk well. You know, you do need some sort of assessment framework in order to be able to justify, you know, the positions or views you're having. Which takes me on to conduct risk, and I think this is probably the biggest area coming forward from a regulatory perspective in the next few years in the Oz market. Because at the moment, you know, my challenge would be to the sector is that no one in Australia yet has a conduct risk assessment framework in place. I haven't seen one if there is, so if people are having one, they're doing very well to keep it to themselves, but I haven't seen it yet in the reviews that I've undertaken on 220 and ICAP to date. And that's not to say that people aren't looking at this issue more broadly, because that would be wrong. But effectively what I'm saying is, I think my challenge is that there isn't actually, no one can really point to a risk assessment framework for conduct. So if you look at on the risk side, we say, well, actually, we have all of the bells and whistles that you would expect for proper risk management. Actually, for some reason, we don't yet apply that on the conduct side. So if you look at all the risk requirements that are there, and I just went through some of those before, you know, your 220, your ICAPs, your CRO requirements, your FCR, your appointed actuary, there is a multitude of risk requirements already around the risk management framework, if you like. I call them the prudential aspects. You go across to conduct, and you look down, and there's just nothing there, basically. So is it any wonder that we've got some of these inquiries and reviews that have been happening over the last few years? Absolutely. And I think that manifests itself effectively into, you know, this issue around claims. I mean, that seems to be the latest issue now going around. And it's basically, for my view, that is basically the presenting issue. The presenting issue is, or we have a claims issue, you know, we're not treating customers fairly on claims. Actually, I think the underlying issue is no one actually has a decent assessment framework in which to properly assess conduct. And if you don't, it manifests itself eventually in, you know, the claims sort of experience. So then you might say, well, what does a conduct risk framework look like? What's he talking about? You know, what should we have that we don't have? And this then goes through, you know, these elements here, you know, around product design, strategy development, how is that actually being developed and managed internally? What are the comms and the marketing processes around that? Sales quality and advice, where's the framework assessment that's actually undertaken within the firms for that? Sales quality assurance and what processes are there? Product governance, post-sales and servicing. Now, they're just a few categories that we've developed in terms of saying, well, if you actually have a conduct risk assessment framework, these would be obviously elements of that assessment process, and you ought to be able to say, here is our methodology for actually how we assess that. It shouldn't be any different to actually how you're assessing some of the prudential risk elements. And now, the reason why this isn't here yet in Oz, I don't think, and it's not really anywhere else in the world, but you're starting to see this in the UK coming through, is because actually the method of supervision by ASIC is still one of thematic reviews. So there's not actually dedicated teams assigned to particular insurers or banks around conduct like there is on the prudential side. And so that remains, I think, a little bit of a regulatory weakness in the Oz market. And I think that will change with the extra funding that's now being given to ASIC. They're certainly, I can be quite open, seeking our views on what that should look like and what they might consider going forward. My view to them is actually it's a glaring weakness that you've got. Because actually, unless you've got some sort of framework that you're asking firms to actually complete and undertake for themselves, what are you actually assessing? And it's very, very difficult. What's your methodology for undertaking your reviews? So that sort of gets us into this, you know, how do you actually manage conduct risk effectively? What should that look like? And here are some suggested, you know, areas that we've got here in terms of how KPMG certainly looks at that at the moment. We have done one or two engagements now because firms are actually getting more, if you like, heat from ASIC around this, and it's an open question to any board member, you know, to say to them, well, when's the last time you went through a conduct risk framework? Do you actually know what that means? How are you assessing how you're treating customers fairly or not? You know, what is your methodology for doing that process? And I think that's a remaining weakness, if you like, in our present system. Now, whether it requires regulation or not to actually force some of that thinking through firms is an open question, but if history is any guide, would we be doing risk appetite and, you know, the strategic analysis that we're doing now if we weren't required to do so with the various requirements? Culture is another good example. You know, no one's really had an assessment framework for assessing culture until APRA's now started to ask for it. So I think this is going to go down a very similar route, but very happy to take questions on that and anything else that you might have.
Well, thank you, Rob and Julian. We've got about 10 minutes remaining for questions, so if any of you are inspired to ask presenters a question or stimulate a discussion, can you just please identify yourself and use the microphone in the middle of the room there? Just while I'm waiting for some of you to be inspired, I had a couple where I thought I might get them talking. One of the things that's intrigued me, Rob, and this is really at an international level, particularly with the imposition of, I think we're now calling it the HLA impost on globally significant insurers, it seems to me that those groups will have a huge competitive disadvantage in their business compared to those who aren't deemed to be globally significant, to the point where some of them might decide they need to be smaller and break themselves up. Have you had any comment?
Cheers, Tony. I actually think there's swings and roundabouts on that one, because at one level you might say, well, you know, this might actually cause a little bit of additional capital to be held. But it's not necessarily on the total balance sheet size, it's really just on the NT&I activities themselves. So there is some sort of carrot and stick there in terms of managing that to a level which is, you know, one of, you know, additional comfort, I guess, that they're looking for. But I think the other sort of quid pro quo for all of this is that actually it stops, if they get it right, it will stop individual jurisdictions and supervisors placing unnecessary capital restrictions on those entities within those markets, for example. So you don't have a collective add-on in, you know, say 10 different countries if you actually had a, you know, a properly sort of rolled out framework that everyone in that college process was then on the same page with. So, you do get, or there should be at least, some sort of kickback in terms of, you know, better management of capital and efficiency of that from having a wider framework. That is slightly different to the HLA context, which is really looking at the NT&I aspect, which your question was. But I think in the total sort of context of it all being brought together, they will look at it at a group level and sort of take the collective view into consideration in terms of overall capital for the group. And that will nonetheless influence what sort of additional capital add-on that they might impose in terms of the HLA for those sorts of NT&I activities.
Anyone else?
Hi, everyone. I was wondering if this movement of having global standards coming in for large insurers, do you feel that over time it will mean a standardization at country level around the world, or will have this patchwork of different requirements and standards forever?
Sorry, can I just ask you to identify yourself?
So my name is Alan Bilan. I work for Swiss Re, based in Hong Kong, but in charge of Asia for portfolio management.
Thanks.
Alan, I thought you might ask that question, because we're hoping to basically in Hong Kong, advising the OCI, that basically what they try and do is mimic effectively something of what the IAS is doing. The good news, I think, for the Hong Kong folk, for example, is it won't be a Solvency II type regime, but it will be consistent with some of the pronouncements coming out from the IAS. And in one sense, they have to, because they get, as you know, I think they get effectively scorecarded by the IMF and the World Bank, you know, all the jurisdictions. So there's periodic reviews of how the, you know, individual countries, their supervisors are actually implementing global standards. The global standard setter for insurance is the IAIS, the Basel equivalent on the banking side. It's been largely a sort of an unknown group for a long time. It's been doing a lot of work sort of in the quiet, if you like. And it's only now that people are starting to go, oh, hang on, this is actually becoming real. And it's simply the FSB is now driving a lot of the change coming through because they've got hold of it and said, actually, we can't tolerate the differences between banking and insurance any longer, and we don't want to do that. Because, you know, that might create unintended consequences such as arbitrage between sectors. So what that's really doing is it's forcing, you know, a lot more commonality between banking and insurance around, you know, the approaches around regulatory requirements and approaches. But in turn, that's also then going down that next level to the individual supervisors. And when they're going through their reform programs now, because there's quite a lot of them still who are still the old claims and premier tests in terms of their solvency requirements, you know, when they're introducing new RBC-type frameworks, they are actually now having a lot of commonality. So 99.5 is effectively the de facto level now. In Australia, it's quite interesting. It's already, you know, above that level because that's basically their, you know, minimum, where, of course, in Europe, that's their sort of maximum target level. So you have quite a, you know, add-on already in Australia. I think it's the most highly sort of capitalised for regulatory purposes in the world, or one of them. And so the issue for APRA, which is quite interesting, it's a complete opposite to the US. The US knows it has to come up and therefore doesn't, you know, how do they actually grapple with, you know, increasing capital requirements? APRA has the reverse problem in a way. They actually are looking at coming back down to meet international global standards if it's set at 99.5. So you have this issue. Australia actually through APRA doesn't want to actually necessarily come down, because if you're a good, prudent regulator, the more that you have if you like, sleep easy cover in terms of regulatory requirements, well, why wouldn't you have it? And why would you give back something that you've already got? So APRA is actually approaching it from a very different perspective than what the US is, yet both of them have sort of formed a bit of a mini team on this at the global stage. Now, whether that sort of changes going forward, I think it probably needs to, because I think now people are saying we've got to get to a common platform here. We can't have these differences. All of the new countries like Hong Kong who are coming through and doing their new reforms are actually all starting to become consistent now in what they're looking for. You know, so the ORSA, for example, the Own Risk and Solvency Assessment, that's a clear, you know, sort of approach. ICAP 220, why are they separate here in Australia? Very odd. You know, why are they also different times? Very odd. You know, so if APRA really wanted to reform, it could say, look, we'll adopt the ORSA properly, have the one framework, integrate the two requirements, have a common, you know, timing, submission date, you know, and actually do it, you know, consistently with what everyone else is now doing. But that actually requires a lot of egos, effectively, being quite blunt, of these regulators to actually accept that maybe they should play ball with their global sort of counterparts and just get on the same page.
Well, unless there are any burning questions out there, I think we may need to begin the process of bringing this to a close. But it remains for me to thank Rob and Julian for an illuminating insight into where the world, I think quite literally, is going in this space and how it might affect us in Australia. There are certainly plenty of other questions I'd like to ask Rob, but I guess I'll have to do that outside. So if I can ask you both, all of you, I should say, to join me just in thanking Rob and Julian.